yes I do. Wanna hold you, yes I do. If I told you, 'cause I do wanna hold you, yes I do wanna hold you, hold you. Some sang, some danced, some Latin romance. I love love. Some sang, some danced, some Latin romance.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and I am joined right now by Simon. I should have asked you how to pronounce your name correctly so I don't butcher it again. Is it a...
Foto.
Okay, I'll just leave it at Foto. Yeah, I can...
Like Mario Lemieux, but...
Okay. I am the worst with trying to do an impression of somebody's voice or trying to do a fake accent or anything. I'm just the worst at it, so I hate when I even have to try to pronounce something French or something like that.
I've heard pretty much every pronunciation of my last name, so it's all good.
So Simon Foteau or Foteau, like I said on the Best of 2015 episode. What's your company, Six Media Marketing?
Six Media Marketing, based out of Montreal. It's a PR company where we do, I founded that in 7 years ago now, and we sort of do anything that's a bit left of mainstream. We don't do like top 40 stuff, but it's either, you know, from rock to jazz to blues to some country. So just stuff that I listen to it, I think it's cool, and it's pretty much how I decide how to take on an act, really.
Wow, and so you're making a business still in the music industry.
luckily enough, it's been 30 years now and 7 years with my own company, so I guess I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, wow. And, I mean, you're the man responsible, basically, for this episode that everyone is about to hear, which is my conversation with one of my all-time favorite artists, really, Michel Pagliaro, who is from, I guess he's from Montreal. Is he... I mean, that's his home base, Montreal, right? Where you live as well.
Yeah, still here. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so first off, thank you, Simon. Thank you so much for making this happen. I can't believe we pulled it off.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been, what, a year and a half in the making, I think?
Yeah, I mean, I went back and looked. I'm guessing that you must have found my show because of my episode number 7 I did, my O Canada episode. Was that when you first found me, maybe?
I don't remember when I first found you. I think it was probably... through either a podcast or something, but I remember going back to that specific episode.
Oh, okay.
And like listening to all these, you know, Canadian bands that I'm into and that I love and that I like, and then I saw heard the show. Then when Pag released the box set a few years ago, friends of mine were doing press with him, and he's not big into doing promo, I don't think. But he's such an interesting character, such an interesting guy, and I figured, hey, obviously you're a fan, so that could be cool, and somehow that didn't happen then. And then when the tribute record came out in November, the Pag Revisité tribute, I remember this, and I went, hey, that could be really cool, because of all the interviews that could have been done non-locally, I thought yours for sure would be like the most interesting one. And then I was closely... you know, I was close to the project, so I figured, hey, let's try it. And then it worked.
Yeah, it actually worked. Yeah, I mean, back on episode number 7, all the way back then, which was in July of 2013 that came out, I opened that show with, I think, 11 Pagliaro, a medley of 11 Pagliaro songs. And yeah, I mean, I've talked about him several times over the course of doing the podcast, because he really is one of my favorites. And he's one of those guys that, I mean, nobody knows about, which is just a crime, especially in America. I mean, well, nothing was ever even released in America by him, which is just crazy, which I talked to him a lot about in the interview. And, I mean, we even get into talking about publishing and all kinds of interesting stuff. He had an interesting take on a lot of that kind of stuff. But, yeah, so here we are.
And people may not know how big the guy was in the 70s here. He was, like, He is a legend, but way back when, he was rock and roll. And he was certainly my introduction to rock and roll with other bands that we have here, like Offenbach and Calbo and all these guys. But Pag was like the giant, the elder statement of rock and roll in Quebec, in both languages, I might add.
Wow. So that's what I wanted to ask you. Yeah, because I don't have a perspective on that, just how famous or how popular he was or still is in Canada, or specifically just Quebec, not all of Canada?
Well, it's mostly a Quebec thing, but it's also because he toured a lot, and the fact that he released records in French and English certainly broadened the scope for him in the 70s. But when it came out, it was so like, it was this rock sound for real that was like from the heart and a real kick-ass rocker. And live, he was unbelievable. Like, I saw him live only once, I think, in 1987 probably, or 88. And I still remember this as one of the best shows I have ever seen in my life. It was so good. So, so good.
Yeah, I believe it. And I think I asked him, if I remember right, I asked him, and I'm pretty sure he said he's never played a concert in the United States. Ever.
Which, I wouldn't be surprised.
It's crazy to me.
It all comes down to the songs. I mean, the guy is, he's a character and he's larger than life. And especially now when you look at him today, how he looks, he's got this really cool looks with the sunglasses, the long hair and the beard and all that. But it all comes down to the songs. And his body of work is unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. And he didn't even know the term power pop when I was talking to him.
Really?
Yeah, because I was telling him, he didn't even know this, I guess, but I mean, if you look at when Some Sing, Some Dance and Loving You Ain't Easy, those songs are from 1971, and that's before Big Star, that's before the Raspberries, that's like before, it's even before Badfinger really started doing their best stuff. So, I mean, he's one of the first that was really doing that kind of music, that early in the 70s.
Certainly inventing a style without even knowing himself.
Yeah, and I asked him about his influences. He doesn't seem to have a lot of influences. I took away from it that he's just a natural talent, and just the songs he wrote are what he wrote, and he didn't really have much of an explanation for it. So basically he was ahead of his time, I think, more than anything, especially as far as maybe the American audience might have been concerned. I mean, if he had been writing those songs a little later into the 70s, I can't imagine they wouldn't have been released in the U.S. and probably even been hits, but I think he was just a little too early, really, more than anything.
Probably, and it was actually surprising to me that it took forever for people to pay tribute to him. Also because he's been out of the public eye for so long. He comes out once in a while and does like maybe one appearance, but it's the kind of artist that you don't hear from. We were hoping for this elusive new record that he's been promising for years and years, but you don't hold your breath because we'd be long dead by now.
Yeah.
and I was it was actually nice to see him back in the public eye in Quebec, at least when the tribute came out, because interestingly enough, press wise, all the mentions is there, here's this tribute record with all these artists, but all the pictures were Pag, because we never see him. So it was an event, just a tribute to him was a tribute to the man and the body of work, but like all the pictures and all the videos and people wanted to do interviews with him and all that. And he didn't do that much. I mean, we did some, but not a ton.
Yeah, I said to my wife that me having him on my show is kind of like somebody who has a Bigfoot podcast getting an interview with Bigfoot, That's kind of how it felt.
Which is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
and to me, I've been doing this a long time, and I worked with some really cool people over the years, and worked with Rob Halford and Tom Jones and Ian Anderson, and I worked with Motorhead and all these guys, and I don't really get nervous anymore about doing stuff, but I didn't sleep too well the night before we did the launch event with Pag, because to me it was like meeting this rock and roll god, and he's from Montreal and with all this history and all, plus the fact that he doesn't do a whole lot of stuff. And so it was certainly one of the highlights of my career so far.
Yeah, I was nervous too to get him on the phone, but he was very nice, and I think we had a good conversation. obviously I asked him about stuff that I'm interested in. So we'll see how many of my listeners are also interested in it. But I mean, after you hear this guy's songs, I don't understand how you could not be a huge fan.
Oh yeah, yeah, you have to go check it out.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And
that there's a compilation that was released probably 10 years ago, 10 to 15, called Hit Parade.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it's been long deleted, but it's such a good comp. It's a 2-CD set, just packed and packed and packed with hits. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I have that. I also have almost all of the records on vinyl. And last year, I think it was about a year ago maybe that all of his stuff finally appeared on iTunes. Almost all of it now is available in America on iTunes. There's only a couple of like B-sides and stuff that aren't on there. Almost all the great stuff from the 70s is there. So.
And they finally put it out when they released the box set. And remember the... friends of mine working on press were calling it DigiPag, which I thought was pretty cool.
It's so annoying. I spent so many years. I mean, I remember the last one I got was the single. It's Revolution, and then the B-side is a song called Illusion that's not on anything else. And that was the last one that I finally tracked down, I don't know how many years ago. And now it's like... Yeah, you don't have to track it down. It's all on iTunes. You know, I'm so busy.
Yeah.
I'm so busy just waiting for it to show up on eBay at some point. You know, but yeah, now it's. I mean, the internet has made as you know keeps making this stuff easier and easier, which I guess there's good and bad to that. I mean, part of the fun of being a music collector was the tracking down that elusive record, and now when it's just like, you know, you could be in your pajamas in your living room, and just get it in 5 seconds.
24 hours a day too. That's the budget killer right there.
Yeah. So how many big hit songs did he have? I mean, does he have a string of hits there that people still know to this day that are kind of classic songs?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You know, even all the way back to the last record, it was Les Bombes, L'Espion. There's also, mm-hmm. you know, Loving You Ain't Easy, of course. Rain Showers, which was fantastic. What the Hell I've Got. And, of course, the big one is J'entends Frapper, which is the absolute classic tune. If you want to define Pag by one song, I mean, it's more than that, but the one song that's so associated with him is that one. J'entends Frapper. There's been tons and tons of versions of that tune. It's the song. I mean, everybody knows this song.
Really? Just, it's like one of those universal songs, just a revered classic?
It's a bona fide classic, you know, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's like almost like a Born to Be Wild, where you go like, oh, I can't hear that song anymore. But when it comes on, you go, hey, that's a good song, classic, you know?
So thanks again for setting up this interview, and now I guess I'll push play and everybody will get to hear my conversation with Michel Pagliaro.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's great to speak with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, you're quite welcome. I was surprised that they said, somebody's going to call you. He wants to talk to you. I said, well, that's great stuff. You know,
I'm just such a huge fan of your work. Here you are. I can't believe I'm talking to you right now.
Well, I'm very flattered. Very interesting. We'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. I don't know.
Have you ever played a concert in the United States?
Not really, no. I don't think so.
Yeah, that's just crazy to me.
Yeah, I know. It's just like this stuff like that happens sometimes, you know. It's like life has different roads sometimes. But anyway, it's never too late. I'm still around.
Yeah, I mean, please. I'll travel to come see you, but...
We gotta find somebody who's willing to hear me sing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the problem any rock and roll artist has these days in the United States is trying to get an audience. Yeah, I mean, I remember very clearly when and how I first discovered your work. You know, I was born in 1974, so it wasn't that simple for me to become familiar with you. But since I'm just such a huge rock fan and especially 70s rock, I'm just always trying to find out about new stuff. And I remember. About 15 years ago, probably like 2001, I was living in New York then and spending too much time on eBay, you know. And have you ever heard of the magazine Bomp magazine from the 70s, B-O-M-P?
B-O-M-P?
Yeah, Bomp magazine. There was also a record label. There was I got an issue of that.
I have to tell you, Brian, I'm not... Brian, right?
Yeah, Brian.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I'm not really a sort of like... following collector kind of guy. I've never really done that. You know, I'm not, it's not me, you know, like I don't even collect records. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, that is me.
I just listen to the same bass drum all day.
So I got this Bomp magazine from 1978 and this was, you know, in like 2001 when I got my hands on this thing and they had, it's actually a kind of a famous issue because it's a power pop issue. And Bomp was a big power pop record label too, out of California. So, but they had a write up in there about the Montreal, 70s Montreal scene, mainly about you and Bob Cigarini. They mainly talked about, but that's where I first read about you. They called you the uncrowned king of Canadian rock and roll. They described your music as the most sterling classic pop rock and roll songs you could desire. That's what they, so when I read that, I needed to hear this. So I went on eBay, you know, this was before even YouTube or the iTunes store. So it was still really hard, to hear
to
anything.
Get access to all these things. Yeah. That's right. I understand. Yeah.
So I went on.
But also whoever's on the other end has got to make his stuff available through these venues too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A lot of the times they weren't, you know what I mean? So,
but you know, it was just a coincidence that I read that and I went right on eBay and somebody was selling the Amber Records version of the Pagliaro record and also the Pagliaro 1 record. And so I ordered those. They came in the mail. And, you know, as soon as I heard some sing, some dance, I was just astonished. I was like, how have I not, you know, known about this? But, I mean, as far as I could tell, you had a couple of singles that came out in the U.S., right? Loving You Ain't Easy on Pi Records and What the Hell I Got.
They're not American. They're British.
Okay.
I don't think it ever came out in America, but it came out in England.
Right. And none of your full-length records, even though you had like RCA, Columbia, and Canada, they never put it out in the U.S.
No, never, no.
And
they could never get a deal for some reason. I don't know.
But
it was always complex, too, because... basically, I mean, I was in New York a few times trying to find out, like, what I could do. But, you know, you got to do a lot of stuff that, like, and people don't necessarily want to be involved. You know, you need like, the whole army with you. You need your own thing, you know what I mean? Like, it's, like, it's very complicated.
Yeah, but it's just baffling to me that a song as great as Some Sing, Some Dance, they don't see that, they don't want to release that. I just can't even comprehend that.
I have no idea. To tell you the truth, I never really followed the thing through either. Like, you know, it's like it didn't happen. They didn't release it. Well, okay, well, I'm doing something else. You know what I'm saying? I didn't say, like, you know, like I'm trying to bang down the door in the corridor to try to get through. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
So, but basically... You know, I lived in France for a long time, too, and I did things there. It was all interesting for me. It's like I always dabbled in the two things, like doing songs or writing songs, doing shows, doing studio as a producer and stuff like that. I mean, I enjoy it all. And I like to play shows, obviously. And but we've never really had any sort of like opportunity to get any sort of like serious production or serious promotion exterior to Canada, or even then, you know, the promo for Canada was even in the beginning. It was sort of like, even the record company that signed us in the beginning, they had radio stations. They didn't even want to play it because they didn't want to look biased, you know, so they were waiting for other people to play it so they'd start playing it, you know, and that kind of thing. But that's the way the world goes, you know. Sometimes it doesn't even go, it doesn't always go where you think it will. But
right,
basically, the reasons for creating the music was not, the intention was more to try to do something that was, I don't know, that worked at the moment, you know what I mean? That sort of like it was doing something, there was a tune there or whatever, but I wasn't dreaming about like sort of like stardom or whatever it was, you know what I'm saying?
Right,
it
wasn't, right.
It was just the music, and the tune was good, and we tried to record it the best we could, and that kind of thing, you know. It was like more like a trying to make the idea live by giving it enough craft to float, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So you first picked up a guitar, was it still even the late 50s? I mean, it was before the Beatles when you started playing, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when did, how early?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you'd call that playing, but anyway, you know.
But your interest in being
could,
a musician.
You could get blisters, you know, you're working on it, you know. But, yeah, it's, but, you know, sometimes, like, I was kind of a lonely kid, so there was a few kids around my house that played a little bit of music, so my father bought me a guitar, so I started, like, playing on the balcony, and then I started hanging around with these kids, and then sooner or later we started doing these Saturday night dances in schools and stuff, and then clubs, and then, you know, like, I just kept going into that, you know.
So
and basically, I got a chance to play a lot of different types of music, because at that particular time, too, especially, well, I don't know if it was the same or some, you know, like, if you didn't have any horns or you didn't play any cha-chas, you wouldn't get any gigs, you know.
Yeah.
So even though the Beatles became sort of like a guitar quartet in the beginning, you really hear a lot of cha-chas influenced stuff, because cha-cha was like the thing, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So who was it that inspired you to first start playing and writing songs?
I that's a difficult question, because, I mean, you get influenced by so many things. I don't really know if it, like, was one particular thing, or it's not coming up right now. I mean, you know, like, I mean, we'd listen to the Ventures, you know, just the instrumental guitar stuff, but that, I didn't really become a fan of that, but I sort of like the singing groups. I'm not necessarily a group fan, but more like the piece itself, you know, like I might like one tune from one guy, another tune from another guy kind of thing. I'm not necessarily, I don't follow through like everybody's art
right
that deep, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think there's a pretty recognizable difference between sort of the rock and the pop music of the 60s and then the 70s. There was a big shift, I think, in the 70s, just in the way songs were written, and I guess the melodies became more complex, or there was just more creativity.
Well, yeah, well, the 60s was still kind of quite pop. Lots of R&B, too, that sort of like not, you know, like there was like so much Four Tops, Supremes, all that stuff, all the Tamla Motown stuff that was like right in the same period, but for some reason, they're not necessarily being sort of like history, you know. History is not that kind to to that bag, because it was very popular too, you know.
Yeah.
So, but the Beatles is still kind of quite popish, even though it had a rock taste to it, which would that had a different sound, though. I remember the first time I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand. The sound of the guitars were like completely different than what we're used to hearing as a American, let's say, American recordings or American tones. The tone of the guitars were like completely different, sort of very sort of like gargly and muffled. Interesting. but they had tunes that, and they were different. The I think what made them stick out was the originality too. They had a different and the lyric content too was sort of more had more quality to it than what you were usually getting, you know. Like there was something interesting about it. And then a lot of groups were happening there too, you know. Like in,
yeah, Beatles, were you inspired by maybe Badfinger?
Badfinger sort of like a group. I remember they used one of their tunes in the Magic Christian movie.
Yeah.
But not necessarily, no. Although, you know, like it's because I can tell, like, because especially from that first record, like a lot of it is sort of like kind of Beatlish maybe. But it wasn't necessarily done in a way that like we're trying to like make it that way kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's sort of like was the say flavor of the month kind of thing. You know what I mean? More than like a quest, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I look at what was happening in, say, 1971, when you came out with Lovin' You Ain't Easy and Some Sing, Some Dance, there really wasn't very much that sounded like what you were doing yet. It seems like you were ahead of the curve as far as writing that kind of what we call like power pop now.
What do they call it?
Power pop. You know that
power
term?
Power pop?
Yeah.
Okay, power pop, yeah.
How great those melodies were, and so infusing that kind of 70s rock and roll with those kind of really catchy melodies. There wasn't a lot of that happening yet. You were really early on in doing that, from, as far as I can tell.
Okay. Well, you would know more than I would, because I wouldn't be able to... No, I wouldn't be able to situate it, you know? I don't have any gauge for it. I'm not in the soup, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like and I wouldn't know how to categorize it or how I'd feel about what category or whatever it should be or shouldn't have been or what, no, I wouldn't know, you know.
Well,
so it's good you're telling me, now I know.
Well, two of the main bands that always get brought up are Big Star and the Raspberries, but neither of those bands came out until 1972. So you beat them to it, as far as I can tell, you know, which... So I was just wondering where those songs came from. Because you were writing kind of the more bluesy rock and roll songs, and you were also writing these really great pop songs at the same time. Was that kind of a conscious thing, or was it just whatever song you wrote, that's what you wrote?
Well, I mean, there's always a bit of conscious and unconscious going on, you know what I mean?
But yeah.
Basically, I've never really sort of like said, okay, I do this kind of clothes and I'll be doing this kind of clothes all the time. You know what I mean? I don't necessarily go after the thing that should be. I'm sort of more, sometimes I try to do stuff that's out of the box often to just, I don't know, for like an adventure of some sort or trying to see what happens, you know, instead of like, let's say, always digging in the same pot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that way, well, you get a chance to sometimes find a certain thing that wasn't necessarily supposed to be in the box, but fits quite well because you find a way to interpret it or do it, that even though it's not necessarily a mainstream sort of like theme or feel, it could still make it conscious to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, so all of your early stuff was all pretty much in French, but then when you started writing these songs, Loving You Ain't Easy, Some Sing, Some Dance, you shifted to English. Was that with maybe the U.S. and England in mind, or was it more just the rest of Canada, or?
No, I don't think it was geographical. I think it was always sort of like a quest to make stuff in English, because obviously, I mean, that's, you know, that's where the thing is. I mean, you know, you're not, the French stuff was sort of like you know, be able to cover the immediate surroundings kind of thing, because there still is a market for French, although very small in North America anyway.
Yeah.
I'm part of the furniture, you know what I mean? So like, obviously I'm not going to start not doing that. So, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the only quest should be that. I mean, so obviously when you're a kid, you want to do like songs in English because you want to get somewhere else. The records never came out anywhere else except England and maybe in Europe and a couple of other places, but we never had any American releases on any of these things. So, you never know. Maybe tomorrow we'll have it out there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. What was that record label, Much Records? Was that a pretty small label or...?
It's a label that was, let's say, a subsidiary of Chum Radio, if you put, which is a Toronto-based station, or used to be. I don't even know if it's still there.
Okay.
You know, when you turned Chum upside down, it read Much. So that's.
Oh, I see. I get it. So was it on the level of sort of a major label in Canada, or was it a smaller operation?
It was a small operation, for some reason the British man who passed away not long ago was a sweet guy. He came from England, but he wanted to do English bands that came from Montreal. He came to Montreal, I guess, because a lot of Toronto people were already there, so he decided to come to Montreal, and they had their label here in Montreal.
So what do you remember about writing those songs, like Some Sing, Some Dance? Do you remember writing that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Ooh, you, how
Some dance that was done maybe inside 20 minutes.
Really?
Really, I was just sitting down and I sort of came up with like the riff and it all poured out in one shot kind of thing.
I mean,
sometimes it happens like that. Sometimes it doesn't. Like Loving You Ain't Easy is probably like, it was probably like parts and then, you know, a little bit later you find the bridge and then you sort of glue it all up together and then you record it kind of thing, you know. It's only result, you know, like if it takes you 10 seconds to do and it's great and everybody says, wow, that's great. Who cares how long it took the guy? You know, like, I mean, it might take you 50 years and everybody looks at it and says, wow, that's shit. You know,
yeah.
So they're not going to say, wow, yeah, but it's 50 years he's been working on it, man. He should have started doing something else before. You know what I'm saying? Because it's not the quantity of time you put on something that gives it any kind of artistic appreciation. It's like what you get from it, you know. And if it took the artist 10 seconds or 10 years, that's his problem, you know. But if your enjoyment is that, you want to find out about it, good for you. But it shouldn't alter... the process shouldn't alter your satisfaction and whatever you're getting out of it. You know? It shouldn't sound like work, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. So were those songs hits in Canada?
Well, I imagine they played for a while. They still play. I mean, you know, not as frequently as they used to, obviously. They are always part of some, gold or whatever they call it, you know, past hits or whatever.
Yeah.
It's hard to quantify hits. You know, sometimes people really like the tunes. They don't necessarily hear them that often, but they know them and they like them, you know.
I know that everyone that I play, like some sing, some dance for, they love it. And I really think if that song had been released in America and played on the radio in 71 or 72, I can't imagine it wouldn't have been a hit song because...
Well, it had a lot of good critique out of West Coast and, you know, record guys and stuff like that. Like, you know, a lot of people tried to plug it and stuff, but for some reason there was never any follow-through on the business side, I imagine. I really wouldn't know, you know. I wouldn't know what to tell you.
I think maybe it was just too early. You were too ahead of your time a little bit there, maybe.
Oh, well, maybe, who knows, maybe. But it's hard for one to tell, you know, if you're ahead of your time. It's sort of pompous, you know what I mean? I'm ahead of my time, yeah, right. You know, step into the rubber room, please. Yeah.
speaking of rubber rooms, another one of my very favorite songs of yours is the song Sure Maybe. From that same Pagliaro record from 71.
Okay.
And you talk about a mental institution in that song. So I guess that's a good segue. Do you remember writing that song? That is such an upbeat, you know, really fast paced, just great 70s rock song.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's a lot different from...
I've never really, I'll tell you the truth. Probably the last time I played it was when I played on the record, you know.
Really?
Really. So, you know, like a lot of them, like we do a lot of shows. I do a lot of shows, but I don't necessarily, the songs that I do live are like good for me live. Sometimes other ones that are good on albums, sometimes they're fun, but live they're not necessarily that interesting or to me, you know. And seeing that I'm the guy singing, so I sort of like get the first call.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Things are like that. Sometimes your songs, sometimes they keep living as records, but they don't necessarily as live stuff. And then I guess if they get popular enough that you don't have any choice but to sing them live, well, then that's your problem, you know? You know, you do what you have to do.
There were a lot of acoustic guitars on all of those early songs.
Yeah, 12-string.
Yeah.
Acoustic 12-string for, like, a lot of those, Something, Some Dance, and Rain Showers, and Loving You. They're like the 12-string guitars, yeah.
Yeah, even Sure Maybe, which is a much more upbeat song, you still hear mostly acoustic guitars on it.
Yeah, I think there's electric lines on top, but I think it's, like, basically, the rhythm section's always, like, acoustic bass and drums kind of thing.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And then even the next record, the Peg record, that came out on RCA in Canada. And that's a French record, but, you know, and I don't speak French, but I love that record. I love the songs. They're so great. The song, you know, I hope I don't pronounce this too poorly, but Je Serai Libéré, you remember that one?
Je Serai Libéré,
yeah. I love that song. Such a great melody, and that's a mostly acoustic song, too. And Chez Moi, uh-huh. Chez Moi.
Uh-huh.
Those are such great pop songs. But then on the same record, you have really great, just bluesy kind of 70s rock songs as well. So right. There's such a mix on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes the mix comes from the fact of having recorded what you have. And all of a sudden you put out an album with the stuff you have recorded, you know.
Yeah.
It's not always, they're not always sort of like generated as albums. You know what I'm saying? Like you're walking in and you're getting budget to do an album. Sometimes there's just like, different cuts for different sessions put together, plus maybe more sessions done in the shot to try to create a whole 10 cut or whatever many cuts there are on an album. You know.
So
today they're more on project stuff. So people will have sort of like a continuity of something like throughout much easier than before where, you know, whether you listen to a Beatle album, although some of the last ones, they were a bit more conceptual than they said, but the other stuff, you could tell there's like different sessions and different things. Or you listen to old rock and roll guys too, you know, like whether it's Chuck Berry, Little Richard, or James Brown, or whatever it is. I mean, they're all different cuts, you know.
But then you moved on to sort of more complex arrangements, like on the Pagliaro 1 record, like I Don't Believe It's You. It's much more produced, I guess, would be one way to describe it. So when you made the Pagliaro 1 record, like I Don't Believe It's You, were you taking a different approach? Were you trying to make a bigger sounding record?
I'm not sure there was any kind of direction as far as vision.
It was just more of a progression?
Sometimes, well, you know what happens too, is like sometimes you change musicians and stuff and then that changes the whole thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't sound the same, so... Obviously, it's going to be different because you don't have the same instrumentalists, so they're not generating the same kind of tones, and it's gone through a different kind of process to get to the end, and blah blah blah. So obviously, it'll have whatever it has, considering this doesn't have songs that are worthwhile calling songs that work with these tones. And then you say no, well, then you got a shit album. If you got a couple of tunes where you're lucky, you know, because basically when you're working with groups, which is what I do, I mean, I always worked with, try to keep it sort of like a group thing, playing with me, and different eras had different people. So sometimes the sound changes. So you, but I don't necessarily say, well, okay, this is the sound they do, so I'm going to create this kind of music. I don't do that. I just like, I use whatever is there and try to create stuff from that, you know, instead of like trying to apply a thought to something, you know. But I've been working on something for quite a few years, different kind of stuff, with different projects that fell through, but I kept the material. I got lots of different stuff. And now I've been working with something with my wife's band, and they're great kids, and we're almost done with a record that is like 12 cuts. There's some in French, but most of them are in English. So I'm looking forward to finishing that. Probably around springtime will be done. So,
wow.
It'll be fun. Yeah. There's some good tunes in there too. So hopefully we'll get a good critique from Brian.
Yeah. I'll definitely be waiting for that. Yeah. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the song Time Race, because it's such a, like, an epic song with a big arrangement, you know, and all the piano and everything. But when I was listening to that song, I was like, who is the drummer on this song? Because the drums are just killer on that. And it's Marty Simon is his name.
Yeah,
it's Marty,
yeah.
Yeah, wow. I was blown away by his work, on, especially on the song Time Race. Really cool. Okay. Yeah.
He's played on a few songs on some of the other records, too.
Yeah.
But Marty, I don't think he plays anymore, but he's always involved in the music publishing things and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, he's listed as a co-writer on that song, too.
Yes. Because sometimes, you know, when you jam with people, they're provoking things and they're doing stuff. So I usually give pieces, you know.
Yeah.
So that way, they not only they get the respect, but I mean, if it works out, well, then maybe they get a couple of bucks, you know. Although these days, not sure that it's going to amount to many bucks, but, you know.
No, but that's a great approach. I think that's a problem with a lot of bands is where, you know, there's a main songwriter, but still the other guys in the band probably deserve some credit for what the song turns into, but a lot of times they don't get the credit and they don't get any of the publishing. So, yeah, I really respect that approach.
Well, the thing is that the publishing, is it's got to be seeded. The publishing doesn't exist unless you give it to somebody.
Okay.
So, basically, what I do is... I make sure that whatever it is that will be created, I mean, at the start, you know, I say, okay, like, I don't know what you guys are going to do. I don't know who's going to give what and who's going to get what or whatever. But whatever it is, everybody's got to release. So, like, you're not running after signatures after the fact, you know, because that's what gets to be a drag. Because that's sometimes... You thought he was your friend, and then all of a sudden he wants something you can't give him, and then it turns into a big pile of dreck, you know?
Okay.
So it's better to say from the outside of the outset that, like, okay, if there will be contributions, this the publishing is already seeded. In other words, like, they'd keep their little bit of the writer's share, whatever it is they contributed artistically, but the publishing is already let go, so... Whoever is going to be making the deal for the record can do make the deal without having problems, you know.
Oh, interesting. People. Okay.
Because a lot of the times, you know, people get upset and you get all these big acrimonies and groups, all that stuff for nothing, for peanuts, you know. And it's like, and they're dividing peanuts and that won't ever be there. And all of a sudden there's this big... argument.
Yeah.
Between people for nothing, you know, for stuff that doesn't exist and that probably will never exist. And all of a sudden, there's this big stuff, and it's better from the outset to make things very clear in the beginning, and that way, whoever's getting on the boat knows what he's getting onto, you know.
Yeah.
And up to him to contribute. If he contributes enough, or if he thinks he did, then nobody else thinks he did. Well, then he shouldn't be getting anything, you know, because there's nothing worse than giving points to someone who doesn't deserve them. Because then it's like cheating, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're cheating somebody else, or you're cheating yourself, and it doesn't make it for anything good anyway. You know? But sometimes people use it as payment. You know, they don't have any money to pay the musician, so they give him a piece of the tune. You know?
Yeah, sure, exactly. You know? Yeah.
You know, but whatever. I'm more of like a my critique on that is more of one of input than one of compensation, you know. Like, I'm sort of a bit hard on the creative thing. Like, I like it if it's real, and if it's not, then it's not, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know what we're talking about, but it's not music.
No, but that was interesting to hear that perspective on it. You always see these bands, you know, people wonder why some bands go out on tour without the main guy. And that's because the Cars, you know, Rick Ocasek made all the money, but the other guys still have to make a living. So then they still have to go out on the road, and he just stays home because he made most of the money because he had the writing credit. And I mean, obviously that broke up a lot of bands, that kind of stuff. So.
Well, it depends. I mean, if the guy did write all the stuff, I mean, then it's right, you know. If you're just telling the guy, okay, you play G for four bars, then you play C for four bars,
yeah,
and that's his contribution, I mean, anybody can do that. So, I mean, if the guy's wanting money for the tune because that's what he's doing, well, that's why he's getting paid also. He's getting paid to play. So, you know, like, it's a work-for-hire thing. If it's like a thing where it's really a creative contribution, the guy came up with the points for the bridge, the melody for the hook, or whatever, you know, like, something like that has some bearing of value to the tune. If you don't have that part, I mean, there's no more tune. Well, you know, or it's not as good as a tune, or whatever it is. Well, then, okay, it's a relative thing. But if he's just being a work-for-hire guy and he's playing the chords in the back, he doesn't deserve it, even though he's got a tone, and even though he's got he did a great solo, this and that. Well, that's why he's getting paid. He's an instrumentalist, you know?
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily make him a composer. or an arranger,
right,
or a writer, you know, which is a lot of other stuff. You know? Anyway.
So when you wrote Time Race, do you remember, were you trying to write a certain kind of song with that song, or was it again just an organic thing, or?
Organic.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like on that album. I remember with the producer, what's his name? I forget. The Peppermint Twist guy. Anyway.
I'm trying to grab my record. Bob Gallo.
Bobby Gallo. Okay, so Bobby, he had the record of Otis Redding, and he wanted me to sing it. So he played the record, and we learned the tune in the studio, and I changed the arrangement around. I wanted Billy to play the acoustic guitar and Marty to use brushes, and we recorded it off the floor. It's like a one-take thing with the singer and everything, and that was the tune, and he really liked that, and we put it on the record. Okay. It was a good version.
Okay, so there, that's
Dock of the
that's
Bay.
That's an interesting insight too. So Dock of the Bay, that's just on the record, just because the producer wanted it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's, I never really thought about that, but that must happen a lot with cover songs too, especially maybe. That's interesting.
We did a good version. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like much less electric, but yet you didn't feel that much electric out of it, kind of thing. You know, there was something like not electric in the instrumentation, like on the original record, he's playing electric guitar and stuff and stuff like that. But it came out okay in a different way, but then again, it didn't take the nature away from the thing, you know. Even though the instrumentation wasn't exactly the same.
So the song Time Race kind of feels to me like a Bruce Springsteen style song. How do you feel about that?
Those kind of things that are like New Jersey, whatever.
Yeah.
It could be that, yeah. It's got sort of an American thing to it.
Definitely the piano.
But basically, it was done in French first.
Right.
This is sort of like it was done after. The Time Race take was done later, like a year or two later, for the lack of songs.
Oh, okay.
sometimes you don't have any ideas, you know? Or you got them, but they're not necessarily that good. Or sometimes you have good ideas, but when you play them, they don't come out right with the band you're with. So you record them, but they don't necessarily come out the way they should. Sometimes it takes time to understand the tune, too. Sometimes, like, you do it, and then you say, hey, why don't we try this instead? And then all of a sudden, the whole thing turns out a lot better.
Yeah.
So, things grow. Hopefully, the guy who does them, too.
So that record, Time Race, came out on Columbia in Canada. What were their hopes for that to come out in the U.S.? Were there attempts made for that?
I have no idea, you know, like you're asking me these type of questions. Basically, I guess these people from Canada couldn't get the other partners to put it out or to get in the back of it through whatever reasons, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't be able to answer you. I don't know.
I know
it didn't come out. So.
I just don't get that. I mean, if you go back to 77 or whatever, you can look at how many shitty records they put out. And they couldn't find a place to put that out in the U.S. It's really flabbergasting to me, but.
I mean, this is show business. You never know. Sometimes you think this is the thing, and then it ain't the thing.
There's an amazing pop single on Time Race called Last Night as well. That's such a great song. Which, you know, I mean, if they could have just gotten that on the radio, I don't know.
Right.
I don't get it.
Well, we'll have to ask Grandfather Time, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hanging around somebody new. Believe me still,
you know what? I sort of like, I guess at one particular point, I was maybe frustrated the fact that for some reason things were not, I mean, we had a lot of different opportunities, but things never sort of opened up or whatever. Could be, you know, like also the people you're with, sometimes the management people are not the right people, this kind of stuff too. Who knows? But basically, if you like to do whatever it is you're doing and you can maneuver yourself through life with the being able to keep on existing or doing what you like to do, well, it's a great fortune, because living off, you know, being an artist is one thing, living off your art is something else. So, you know, that's always the difficult part. And these days, even more so, although you can have access to tools that can give you the opportunity to create music without necessarily going into deep expenditures and have fun anyway, but basically it doesn't necessarily optimize the talent. It sort of dilutes a lot of stuff, and sort of like you could have like a lot of people doing the same kind of thing, so it gets to be very complex. As far as right now, the only thing they're getting pushed is like people who are learning to dance or learning to sing on TV. You know? So.
Yeah. I don't mean to harp on this. I mean, obviously, you know, you should be so proud of the songs you've created, and to make a career in music is such a great thing, a great life to have. So I'm just so frustrated with the idea that these record labels in the 70s couldn't figure out how great your songs were. But I mean, I don't mean to harp on that. It's just annoys me.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't have any, there's no, how should I say, I don't dwell on it. It's not like a thing where I said, it's not the type of soul I want to carry. Do you understand?
Because yeah, no, I understand.
If you're wallowing in regret all the time and like,
yes,
this should have happened to me and I should have had this. I don't give a shit, really. You know?
Right. Like, well, that's very, you know, yeah, very
good. I'm into other things and I'm doing other things, and hopefully some stuff will come off from that, and who knows, you know, like move forward, you know?
Yeah, that's a great outlook. And so, I mean, now you've been working with your son's band, right, Roman?
No, my wife's band. My son has a group too. They're starting to do shows and stuff, you know. But like a difficult thing trying to start new bands and stuff. So they, you know, you got to keep at it, and you got all this social media stuff and all this stuff. I don't really park on it that much because. I'd rather spend my time creating music than sort of like talking to people I don't know. You know what I mean?
Have you produced stuff for Roman?
We've done like a record a couple of years ago. That's like they're still making videos off it. I did a couple of other bands too, Reclo and stuff. They're like French local groups, and I've been working on my stuff too. So like you know. I'm doing that.
Yeah, I bought Roman's band's EP on iTunes, and they have a new single this year that's on there. It's good stuff. I like it.
Yeah, they are original. They have it's pop, but it doesn't. It's not like copy of anything. You know what I mean? They got enough. They got good ideas. You know.
Yeah. Do you want to pronounce his band's name so I don't screw it up?
Les Fous de la Reine.
Right. Yeah.
Les Fous de la Reine means you know the court jester.
Okay.
But usually. The court jester is usually to the king, but not the court jester to the queen.
Ah.
Actually, fou means the crazy about the queen. You know?
Okay.
Crazy is about the queen. You know?
Yeah.
It's hard to translate exactly headspace on that. But anyway.
I like it, though. It sounds cool. And now there's this brand new tribute album called Pig... Revisite, is that what it's
called? Yeah, revisite, right? Yeah, revisited.
Yeah, right.
So the record company here wanted to create these sort of like they do it with a few different artists too, like an homage, an homage album where they took a few of the local artists that have their records out and stuff like that, and they had them pick a song that they'd love to do about me or of my repertoire with their own taste, you know. I really liked he did Si Tu Voulais.
Karim?
Yes, Karim Ouellet, yeah.
Yeah.
He did a very, very, very interesting sort of like hip hop thing with like with this old tune that actually that I wrote. You were talking about Marty Simon before, that I wrote with Marty Simon, and that's it. He did a very interesting version of it, and a lot of them are like quite different from the record, and it's hard for me to, they wanted me to play duos and sing with them and all this stuff, but I didn't feel it was really relevant or necessary. And they get a chance to do the way they want to do whatever they want to do with it without me being in there, it's better, you know?
Yeah.
So they did this album, and it's out now. I don't know how it's doing, but we had a cocktail for a little press conference and stuff, and it was kind of funny because that's the first time I met them. I didn't know them, so that was kind of interesting, and we had a good time. So,
and you're happy with how it came out?
Well, I listened to it. I said it was different to me. Am I to judge how it come out? I think a lot of them are sort of interesting. I like Karim's version a lot. I thought you went quite far to change it, and I think you sort of succeeded in doing something interesting with it. Of the other versions were very interesting too, where some of the arrangements were done in a different way, which is cool. It's hard for me if I have like a more of a critical judgment on it, because I'm not necessarily in a position to do so.
Yeah. Does it feel good to have this kind of a tribute to your work out there? And
well, it's out there.
Yeah.
You know. You know. So, you know, good, you know, like, what are you going to say, bad? You know, no, it's good. The police people did some stuff that they thought was going to be interesting, and they went out of their way to do it. So good for them, you know. Now, is this relevant to where I'm at today and what do I do and all this stuff. Not really, but I can appreciate the fact that they did that because, well, they did it. You know, they wanted to do it and they did it. So, good. Thank you.
So you're hoping to have a new album out next year then? Is that the plan?
That's the plan.
All right, great. I'll be looking forward to it.
Cool.
And thank you. Thank you so much for talking to me, and thank you so much for all of the great music that you've made over
the
years.
You're very sweet. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your podcast. Ryan, thank you very much, and happy Christmas and New Year's and health and all that stuff.
Thank you. You too. And I follow you on Facebook, so hopefully I'll find out, you know, I'll know about your new album as soon as it's coming out and figure
well,
out a
sure
way to get my hands on it.
I'm sure people will be contacting you
yeah.
if that happens.
Okay.
All right.
Well, good
thank
luck with the
much.
New record and everything, and thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, so there you have it, my conversation with Michele Pagliaro. I still can't believe it actually happened. And thanks again, Simon, for making that a reality.
It's the bucket list, for sure.
Yeah, and I guess, like you were saying, this really came about because you're involved in this new tribute album. Are they all Quebec artists on that?
They're all Quebec. It's the new generation of Quebec artists. The record's called PAG Revisité, which is basically PAG Revisited.
Right.
It's the new generation of artists that are really popular here or that are names on the Quebec music scene right now, like the Seasons that we were talking about earlier and Galaxy on there and Rémi Chassé, who was on The Voice, Patrice Michaud as well. There's a really interesting version of Les Bons that the original version is a kick-ass version. Real good driving rock tunes, and he basically took the rock out of it and put it's a groovy sort of version, like really interesting. At first listen, you go like, what the hell is that? Because we're so used to the original version, and he transformed it. And the more you listen to it, the more you go like, this is really cool. There's a cool groove to it. I think this came out. The record company put this together out of true sheer love for PAG and trying to really bring back to the front of the scene how important, how influential PAG is as an artist on the Quebec music scene.
Right. And so your company is involved in promoting this?
We did press for that record, for PAG Revisited. And when they call, an instance where they go, oh, so we have a new project for you. So I go, okay, what is it? It's the PAG. They didn't finish the phrase. I said, yes. If I can be involved with PAG in any way, just not even as a, you know, as a company owner and just as a fan, to me it was like, yes, absolutely yes. I want to get involved in that.
And is that record selling? Is it selling up there?
Doing quite well, actually.
Yeah.
Quite well. I think it's interesting that the new generation of artists are on there because the important thing for artists like that, be it PAG or be it like whoever else, really is the importance of reaching a new generation of fan so that the legacy can continue on.
Yeah.
And it's if you know, if new people discover his music through these versions, then hey, all the best, and this album was worth it, if only for that.
Right.
You know, and of course now we want this new Pagliaro record.
Well, thanks again. Thank you so much for helping me out with this and making this a reality.
Absolute pleasure, and I have to tell you, man, it's an honor to be on Rock and Roll Roll.
To
me, I'm a fan of the podcast. I listen to all of them. You know, I discovered new stuff, and I did, and we, you know, as I was saying earlier, I mean, it's interesting that two guys that never met each other at some point through the power of a podcast, an internet, we connect musically. And that, to me, I think that is really cool.
Yeah.
And it's what music's all about for me. That's why I do what I do.
Yeah, without a doubt, the best thing about having started the podcast is just all of the people that I've met through doing it. All of the other podcasters and the fans. You know, it's just, I mean, when you're a big, big fan of rock music, it's hard to meet other people that are like you. You know, you don't just out and meet them in your everyday life. And so it's just been a great way to meet other like-minded people. And that's definitely been the best part. So,
yeah, and keep bringing it, man, because it is so good. I rediscovered totally Teenage Fan Club, by the way.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah. They're one of the best ever.
How good, you know, this band was.
Yeah.
But there's also something like the Foreigner episode I thought was very cool.
Yeah.
And how uncool is this to say that, you know?
Yeah, that was the whole point. Yeah.
Well, it worked because, you know, you go into a discussion these days like, oh, you know, I listened to, you know, Boston and Foreigner last night. People are going to go like, oh, yeah, well, I listened to, you know, My Morning Jacket and to the, whatever else, the indie stuff, which I'm all fine with. Just that, you know, Kiss, Cheap Trick, and, you know, Angels and the Angels from Australia and Jimmy Barnes. Guys, like, you know, who's going to talk about that?
I love Jimmy Barnes, yeah. Cold Chisel,
yeah. The new record's really good, by the way.
New Cold Chisel?
Cold Chisel, yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know. I'll have to really check it out.
Came out at the end of last year.
Okay.
Very cool.
Wow. And now to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
All right, so let's play a song from the Peg Revisite tribute album. Which song would you like me to play, Simon?
There's so many that we could have chosen out of this record, but I think the reigning kings of rock right now in Quebec are Galaxy, great band, and they really kick ass on their version of Louise.
All right, so here it is, Galaxy with Louise. Till next time.
Rock.
I'll be back.